All right, well, good morning, everybody. As usual, let's begin with a word of prayer, and then today we will be talking about the religion of Buddhism. So, our Father in heaven, we thank you again for this opportunity to come and learn about other religions, those religions which have attempted in various ways to get to you. And Lord, my hope is that as we consider these man-made attempts to reach what all men are made for, relationship with you, that we would get a renewed appreciation and a renewed love of that God who has reached down to us and made a way for us to enter into your presence. Thank you that we have that that truth and that promise, and I just ask that you would both encourage us today and equip us, that we might share the gospel with those in need. We ask this in Christ's name. Amen. All right. So I am very excited about talking about Buddhism for a few reasons. First, because in many ways it provides a very striking contrast with Christianity. Many of the things which Buddhism teaches, I think, throw into sharp relief some of the most beautiful doctrines of Christianity. In fact, I was laughing. I told Pastor Blair before I just a few moments ago, was telling him that he either stole half of my teaching on Buddhism with his sermon today, or just set me up beautifully for the teaching on Buddhism. So we'll go with set me up beautifully. But some of the beauty, some of the hope that we see just in those actions, those promises of Christ that are illustrated nicely in the story that we just talked about this morning, are thrown in very sharp relief by the picture that Buddhism paints. So that's one reason why I'm excited to talk about it. The other is that Buddhism, while it is not that prevalent in America today, it's roughly on par, maybe actually even a little bit more common than, say, Hinduism or Islam. All of those are kind of in the, 1% of American population range right now. So it's not a huge number of people who would be active practicing Buddhists. But it is nonetheless growing very dramatically in really just in American culture generally. It's interesting, actually, something like one survey I saw said about 40% of American Buddhists are in Southern California, surprise. But beyond that, there's quite a range of interest in Buddhism. And, even just think of say, Steve Jobs, again, the very famous Buddhist who is quite actively Buddhist and is in many ways illustrative of the type of American who is drawn to what Buddhism offers. So sort of starting with just the big picture of Buddhism, it is typically considered the fourth largest world religion after Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism. There's roughly, depending on how you measure it, there's about perhaps 200 to 500 million Buddhists in the world. It's a little hard to measure like many religions because you've got sort of the distinction between cultural Buddhists and practicing Buddhists. But again, ballpark 200 to 500 million. Those are largely concentrated in East Asia. Kind of picture a clump from about, say, Mongolia to Japan to Thailand, Cambodia. That region is the heart of Buddhism. Ironically, even though it began in India, it doesn't have a high population of Buddhists today in India. It began with Siddhartha Gautama. I probably butchered the pronunciation, so apologies. We'll just call him the Buddha because that is what his followers call him, which simply means the enlightened one. So Gautama was born ballpark 560 or so B.C., actually born the son of a king. Somewhere up in what was then northeast India, today Nepal. And basically all accounts, he grew up with every possible luxury, all his whims, needs catered to. He is very comfortable, gets a nice wife, is very, very well positioned for just, a pleasant king's life. Yet, Gautama then, as he goes about his life, he comes across in his 20s, suffering. And there's a story told of his leaving the palace and coming upon an ill man and a dead man and just an old man. And then he comes upon a holy man, an ascetic, who is kind of just undisturbed by the suffering of the ill man, the dead man, and the old man. And Gautama is struck by this. He's so disturbed in his soul as to oh, that's awful. What's happening there? And he sees the peace of this ascetic, who would have been some sort of, as we talked about a few weeks ago, sort of the roots of Hinduism. This would have been some sort, most likely, a Hindu holy man. So he sees that, and he wants that. You know, he's just so shaken by this ugliness that he sees, that he desires this peace that he sees in this ascetic. So he goes off, and for about 6 years, from 29 to age 35, he seeks the truth. He seeks learning. He goes to various teachers, various holy men, wanders through the Ganges Valley. At this time, it would have been mostly ascetic teachers. So again, you know, denial of the body, fasting, strict meditation, that sort of thing. And basically, he simply finds that he is not satisfied. That these are not the answers. And so he's described as, you know, wandering. You know, what is there? What is the truth? I'm still confronted by the suffering. What's the answer? And finally, we're told he's sitting under a tree. He's actually sitting under a tree in most of the stories of him. He apparently spent a lot of time under trees. So he's sitting under this tree, and suddenly he has this flash of insight. He sees, and he understands, and he becomes, at that moment, the enlightened one, the Buddha. Now, it's important for us to understand that he never claims to be in any way divine, never claims to be any way inspired. In fact, he's quite definite about that, and that becomes actually a selling point for Buddhism, that this is not something that is, you know, a speculative philosophy from questionable revelation or anything like that. This is just man has discovered it. There's a story that Gautama, shortly after becoming the Buddha, was just walking through the country, and a man saw him coming. And he sees that there's something different about him as he's approaching, and the man says, What are you? Are you a god? Are you something divine? And Gautama says, No. Are you a prophet? Are you some sort of holy man? No. Are you an angel, a divine messenger? What are you? And Gautama says, I am awake. And that is basically the message of Buddhism, is that we are all asleep and that we need to be awake. And that's what he then proceeds to try to teach for about the next 55 years. He lives to be roughly 80. He teaches essentially this path that he has found, that he believes is the way to enlightenment, to being awake, to seeing. He is, upon his death, there's no real written record of his teachings, but basically he had a number of followers who basically through oral recitation keep records of his teachings. Those records extend for about 400 years. You just have oral history of what he said. And then finally they're written down in texts, which today would be the texts of the Buddhist religion. As usual, you know, as we've said with, you know, Islam, with Hinduism, different sects are going to have different texts, which they consider authoritative, which they consider, you know, their texts that they hold to. But none of them are going to have any of these texts being, again, inspired or anything like that. Again, very, very clear that this is an entirely natural thing. There really is nothing supernatural in Buddhism, as presented by Gautama, is simply man has discovered. This is what I see, and this is what I will show to you. It is within you that you too can become an enlightened one. In fact, as he was dying, he gathered his followers around him and said the following, which again, I find a very interesting contrast, very striking contrast to Christianity. So he gathers his followers and says, be a light unto yourself. Betake yourselves to no external refuge. Hold fast to the truth. Look not for refuge to anyone besides yourselves. And so that I entirely, again, I'm a man, I teach you wisdom, you're men, hear the wisdom, follow as best you can. That is the ethos of Buddhism, which incidentally is one of, again, the first reason I'll point out why Buddhism fits so perfectly with the secular humanist perspective of much of our culture today. If I'm already convinced that there's nothing but me, if I already kind of would rather that there be nothing but me, well, it fits very nicely for Buddha then to come along and say, well, yes, that's how it is. and let me show you how to live as best you can, that being the case. Well, to understand what living as best you can means for the Buddhists, we have to consider, again, I'm amused by how well the sermon set me up, we have to consider the problem of suffering, the problem of pain. As we said, that the old man, the ill man, and the dead man are what set Gautama on his path. And that is the selling point of Buddhism, is that it will help you to overcome the suffering, the pain, the frustration of life. It's striking as you read essentially evangelistic books for Buddhism. They have entire sections that I'm reading, and I'm like, this sounds like, you know, mere Christianity. This sounds like Christian writing about the problem of the world. Essentially the Christian perspective on suffering and pain. And there's just a few elements that I want to highlight in order to set up and sort of pull to our mind what we can hold in contrast to the Buddhist picture. So as we think about the Christian picture of suffering and pain, the picture that, remember, you have to present to the Buddhist if you have a chance, I think, you know, as a Christian, as I look at the suffering of, you know, physical suffering, spiritual suffering, suffering of those I love, just angst of living in a world which is off kilter. These things, you know, the Bible says look backwards, and we have an answer to where it comes from. It comes from, again, human sin, human wickedness and rebellion against God. And we see there not only an answer of how then sin leads to suffering and death, but we see also something of an explanation of why it persists. At least to some extent. Again, part of it. Surely we don't fully understand the wisdom and counsel of God on that, but we can see at least to some extent, as Jesus even shows us in the parable of the wheat and the tares. You know, why does sin remain? Why do we have suffering and death, etc. today? Well, it's because suffering and death are inextricably linked to sin. And if we say, Lord, get rid of suffering and death, we're saying, Lord, get rid of sinners. We kind of have had almost the perfect solution, the perfect wiping away of suffering and sin already. It was called Noah's flood, and it didn't work out very well for most of the world. Again, as Jesus says with the parable of the wheat and the tares, why are the tares left? Out of mercy, that not yet will you be utterly wiped away. Not yet is the day of judgment, after which there's no turning back, that it will come, but not yet. And the not yet era in which we live is because of mercy, because that he will not destroy us, will not destroy sinners yet. So we have then, looking back, we see an explanation of where sin comes from, where suffering comes from, and why it persists. Looking forward, of course, we see the hope, we see the ultimate promise of sin, suffering, and death ending, that it's done. After a certain point, when the final harvest comes, when, in fact, that is ultimately wiped away and swallowed up in victory. And then in the moment, and this is perhaps even the most striking contrast with Buddhism, in the moment as our answer to suffering, we have the picture of God. We have God himself as he was in the boat on the Sea of Galilee. We have God with us. And two things that I want to highlight for our thought as we move to look at the Buddhist picture is first the sovereignty of God. It's interesting that, yes, to some extent on a philosophical level, God's sovereignty causes questions of, you know, well, why does he permit sin? Why does he permit suffering? Why does he allow this to happen to me? And that has actually led some Christians to hold to view, well, some Christians-ish, to hold to views such as process theology, which basically say that God is sort of learning as he goes. You know, he's doing his best, and he sees bad things, he sees suffering, and he's like, man, we should do something about that. And he tries, and eventually he makes the world a little bit of a better place. And obviously, yes, that does at least explain where suffering comes from. Unfortunately, it does it by getting rid of God. So that doesn't seem like an adequate theological answer, and frankly, it's not an adequate answer as to comfort. I was reading an interesting, just one of those articles you stumble on the internet, wasting time. Stumbled on this article from a woman talking about this suffering, that She had gone through just a weight of great suffering, and she was describing how in her suffering she didn't understand it, but nonetheless the great comfort she held to was the sovereignty of God. That she knew that God permitted every bit of what came to her. And just like a child having some sort of painful medical experience that you don't fully get it, okay, I don't know why Daddy is holding me down, why this awful painful thing happens from the doctor, yet it is Daddy. And he is allowing it, and therefore I can trust in him. Which, of course, brings to the other aspect that Christianity offers in answer to the problem of suffering, which is the love of God. Again, that we not only have the sovereign God, but we have a God who loves us perfectly. And I think strikingly, this is just the one aspect, surely I don't need to go in at great length as to the love of God, just one aspect that I think is worth highlighting in connection with Buddhism specifically, and that is that God not only loves us in theory, not only loves us, from on high in heaven, but as, again, the sermon spoke of, he came and took on flesh, that he suffered with us and for us, and that, as we look to the question, okay, why does God allow me to suffer? He does not fully explain it, but he does say, I suffered with you, I suffered for you, I suffered more than you on your behalf. There's a story, actually, it comes from India. I remember reading some years ago that always stuck with me as just an illustration of this, a story of an Englishman who was at a banquet in India, and he was telling this hilarious story about a cowardly Raja who was at an elephant hunt, and this Raja was terrified. And so basically in the middle of the hunt, the Raja just flees away and runs, and it's very funny, everybody's laughing, blah, blah, blah. Well, the Englishman finishes the story, and the gentleman sitting across from him looks up and says, I've heard that story before. I was actually the guy in the hunt. That was me that ran away. And I can't tell you honorably why I had to leave the hunt, but I would not have you think that I was a coward. And so he put his hand on the table and he drew his dagger and plunged it through his hand into the table and said, I can't tell you, but I can show you that I'm not a coward. And I think there's a similar sense in which as I come to God and say, why do you let me suffer? He also can hold a pierced hand and say, I cannot fully tell you. I'm God. You don't fully understand my purposes and plans, but I can show you that there's a reason why suffering is necessary, and I took it on myself as well. So that is the picture of suffering that the Christian has, that explains it, that offers ultimate hope, and that gives us one with us who suffers alongside, who has suffered for us, and ultimately, again, will end that suffering. Well, the picture of suffering that Gautama had before becoming a Buddhist was, of course, quite different. Remember, we talked about Hinduism the last few weeks. What's the Hindu picture of suffering that would have been prevalent in his culture? Suffering as the result of karma. Suffering as the result of, I've done bad things, and I bear the weight. And I don't even have the escape of death. The worst torment, I'm being tortured by Apache Indians or something. What's the hope of the tormented man? Death. Well, you can't even escape suffering through death for the Hindu. You just cycle back through. And maybe, after generations and generations and generations, maybe you can get out of the cycle of suffering and death. That's the picture of suffering that Gautama is in as he now tries to work out, okay, how should I live? What is it to be human? And how ought we live our lives in the presence of this persistent suffering? Which brings us then to the answer that he offers. And in working through Buddhist doctrine, before we get to his sort of the heart of his doctrine, I want to start actually just by making a note, sort of distinguishing between a Buddhist picture of religious truth and a Christian picture of religious truth. And this is another way in which Buddhism fits very nicely with the secular, humanist, science is everything perspective of our present day, because the Buddhist emphasizes violently, it's a nonviolent religion, but metaphorically, emphasizes violently that it is not dogmatic. It is not theological. There's a strong distinction that Buddhism draws, I think a far too strong distinction, between what they would call belief or faith and knowing or experiencing. One of the most common illustrations they give is, I can hold out my hand and I can say I have a gem in my hand. And if you trust me, then you might believe I have a gem in my hand, but you could still question it. And the Buddha says, however, if I open my hand, then there is no longer any doubt. You have experienced the gem in my hand, which again is far too tidy of a distinction, as philosophers have been working out for centuries, that in fact that's not necessarily quite an accurate picture, but we'll perhaps return to that later. For now, though, just if we're thinking of how the Buddhist is going to see things, the appeal is going to be, I'm not trying to get you to believe something you can't experience. I'm not asking you to have faith. I'm not asking you to, trust me or anybody else. In fact, the Buddha himself said, don't just believe it because I'm the Buddha. Believe it because you've experienced it. So the appeal, anyway, again, I would argue, as we'll talk about later, it's really not nearly this, it's not an accurate appeal, but the appeal is, we're not asking you faith. We're not asking you to believe. We're asking you to hold to what you have experienced and therefore cannot doubt. In fact, in general, Buddhism is very skeptical of metaphysical type speculation, of questions of, ultimate truths. It presents itself as just a very practical, here's where you are, here's your problem, let's fix it. Buddha has a famous story that he told, where he says that people are like a man who's been shot by an arrow. And he's brought into the doctor, and he's like, wait, don't operate yet. First, we need to know what color was the arrow, and who made it, and what did he look like, and what kind of bow was it shot from, and what kind of bowstring was it strung with, and who made the bow, and why did he shoot it? And Buddha says, well, forget all those questions. Just get the arrow out. And that's essentially the picture that Buddhism offers of itself is, we put aside, metaphysical speculation itself is, we put aside, metaphysical speculation itself is, we put aside, metaphysical speculation itself is, again, if you think of much of today's society, you see how nicely that fits with a society which is no longer confident in our ability to know ultimate truth, no longer assured of there being ultimate truth. Well, put all that aside. Don't worry about that. Let's just get the arrow out, is what the Buddhist offers. Well, what is the arrow? What is the problem? This, then, leads us to the Four Noble Truths. Buddhism has a lot of numbered lists, which I actually think is significant, and we'll come back to that maybe in a bit. But a lot of numbered lists, and perhaps the first numbered list for us is the Four Noble Truths. So the first of the Four Noble Truths, which form the heart of Buddhism, is dukkha. If you're taking notes, that's D-U-K-K-H-A. D-U-K-K-H-A. But again, it's basically just pronounced dukkha. So dukkha is a Sanskrit word which means a wheel out of kilter. And it's describing the dilemma of the fallen world. Well, I suppose we could actually. Yes, we could translate it fallenness, though obviously for the Buddhist that wouldn't be satisfactory because exactly. And because fallenness implies, again, there's something wrong. There is something wrong for the Buddhist, but it's the Christian has a sense of it being wrong because there should have been something right that's broken. Whereas for the Buddhist this is how things are. So yes, for a Christian we can very nicely think of it as fallenness. Even though, again, the Buddhist wouldn't, again, a fall implies you've fallen from somewhere. Whereas for the Buddhist, it's simply this is the world. This is how it is. So so dukkha includes then again pain and suffering, obviously, but also just that sense of the world never to satisfy. Of again, we always want the next thing. And when we get the next thing, we're afraid somebody's going to take it, or it's just going to disappear. And we're worried about the thing after that. So just all of that fallenness. All of the symptoms of death in the world is dukkha. And so the first noble truth for Buddhism is simply to recognize that dukkha is. And in fact, that it is how things are, that it's natural, that it's normal, and that we should not try to get away from it. There's another striking story. Buddhism just has some great stories. So this story is the story of a farmer who comes to Buddha and says, Buddha, I've got all these, I'm a farmer, and I generally, I like being a farmer, but I got all these problems. And so I got, you know, sometimes it rains too much and the crops die. Sometimes it doesn't rain enough and the crops die. And sometimes just I don't feel like farming. And I got this wife, and she's pretty good, but I mean sometimes. And then I got these kids, and they're pretty good, but you know, sometimes. So I got, and he keeps going and going, and Buddha's just sort of nodding. And then finally gets in, and he's like, well, I've heard you're a really great teacher. You're really wise. You're the enlightened one. What can you do about this? And Buddha says, well, nothing. And the guy, you know, understandably is somewhat loudly perturbed at this. And, well, I thought you were, I traveled all this way. Can't you do anything for me? And Buddha says, well, see, the thing is, everybody has problems. And, you know, you can work really hard on one problem, and if you solve that problem, well, you're just going to have another one pop up. And he likes just numbers. So he's like, everybody has 83 problems. So everybody has 83 problems. We all have 83 problems, nothing you can do about it. And the guy's like, well, what good are you? And Buddha says, well, I can help you with your 84th problem. He says, well, what's my 84th problem? You don't want to have any problems. That's dukkha. That basically you need to recognize, the Buddha says, that you have problems. That's the world. And again, unlike the Christian that looks forward to, well, looks back and looks forward, but says there's something wrong. Problems shouldn't be here. Problems aren't natural and problems will end. And looks forward to say there will be a time when there will be no more pain, suffering, and sin. For the Buddhist, just this is what we have. This is what we are, dukkha. So the first noble truth is dukkha, that there is sin, there is suffering, there is depression, and that's just how it is. If I may do one more story, because I do just love these. They're so illustrative. There's a story of a Zen monastery where there's this monk who gets just tired of being a Zen monk. It requires a great deal of self-discipline. It requires a great deal of just a lot of not very fun things from his perspective. So he comes to the Zen master and he says, I'm leaving. And the Zen master says, fine. Again, very much a do what you will ethos to Buddhism. So, fine, go. So the Zen monk goes to the door to leave, and the Zen master calls and says, oh, wait, that's not your door. So he goes, okay, whatever, goes to the next door, the other door out, and he, wait, that's not your door either. And, well, okay, and there's like a little door behind the master that he uses, so he goes to that, and that's not your door either. And he gets mad, like, what do you, if there's no doors, how am I going to get out? And the Zen master says, well, if you have no doors, might as well just sit down. And again, that's the ethos of Buddhism. There's no doors. It's all dukkha. Might as well sit down. Which leads then to the second noble truth, which is, okay, where does dukkha come from for the Buddhist? Well, to understand where dukkha comes from, we have to recycle backwards a little bit to dukkha once again, because there's one more piece of dukkha which we haven't covered yet, which is one of the confusions, one of the problems with us, is we think we exist. That's a major problem, and it's not true for the Buddhist. There is no such thing as a self. There's no such thing as I or me. Buddha says, just as a man shudders with horror when he steps upon a serpent, but laughs when he looks down and sees that it is only a rope. So I discovered one day that what I was calling I cannot be found, and all fear and anxiety vanished with my mistake. Well, why does the Buddhist say you don't have a self? I knew that this is going to be where we're going to have questions, and please do ask questions, but I think I can perhaps illustrate it as best as I can with this little illustration. So somebody tell me, this thing that I printed off last night, what is this a picture of? The Chick-fil-A cow, indeed. It's like a Rorschach test, or an ink blot. No, actually, he's wrong, though. This isn't a picture of anything. It's just dots. If you know how a printer works, there's just little dots. And if I get really close and microscopic, well, the cow's not there anymore. It's just little dots. And that's essentially, as best I can analogize it, that's what the Buddhist does to people. Is that they get close enough, they break us down to our pieces, and there's no soul in this, there's no soul in that, so there is no soul, there is no self. Buddhism breaks people down into, I told you there'd be numbers, the five aggregates. So basically this just means the various elements of being human, the body, the mind, sensations, desire, etc. So there's five elements of being human, and it's true. My body is not myself. My mind is not myself. My emotions are not myself. And therefore, searching through all the pieces, Buddha concludes, well, there is no self there. And therefore, the illusion of the self, that we imagine there is a self, is the cause of suffering and pain and dukkha. Because if you have a sense of a self, if you have a sense of, I want things, I need things, I desire things, this hurts me, that produces what is often called thirst. Or I read one Buddhist teacher who called it simply leaning. So you want, you're inclined towards this or that. So I don't want this, so I lean. I want that, so I thirst. And so essentially this illusion of the self that you think you exist creates this tendency to lean, to thirst, to desire sensory pleasure, to avoid sensory pain, to want to continue existing because you have the illusion that you exist in the first place. So to try to continue existing, to try to avoid non-existence, but also to seek non-existence because you're just tired of the cycle of existence. So all of these things create a thirst, but the thirst itself is felt by nothing. A famous Buddhist scholar, again, my apologies for pronunciation, Buddhaghosa, I believe, says, mere suffering exists, but no sufferer is found. The deeds are, but no doer is found. If we could draw perhaps an interesting contrast with René Descartes, the famous French philosopher who says, I think, therefore I am. Basically, Buddhism says, thought is, but I am not. That there is no thinker for the thought, that it's just a collection of desires and thoughts, etc., but there's no permanent constant you. Well, because we have this thirst, this leaning caused by the illusion of self, Buddhism says, then we are sucked back into, wait for it, the karmic cycle. It's back. So much like Hinduism, but not completely, we have an idea of karma. And in fact, we have reincarnation, which should raise questions in your mind. How does the self get reincarnated if it's not there at first? Which we'll explain in a second. But very much like Hinduism, karma is, for the Buddhist, just the natural cause and effect of actions. Now, for the Buddhist, there is no objective basis for right and wrong. Buddha says, as you get more enlightened, you realize that all distinctions, such as the distinction between right and wrong, good and evil, those are man-made categories that have no truth. So the Buddhist would not tell you to make moral judgments. There's no foundation for saying this is right and this is wrong, but there are things with good or bad effects. If, for example, I go and kill somebody, that makes them unhappy, it probably makes me unhappy, I guess I get bloody. For whatever reason, it doesn't have a good effect. And therefore, that's bad karma. So karma is always choice for the Buddhist. It's slightly different terminology. The karma is the choice, and therefore the moral effect of your choice is then good or bad, depending on the goodness or badness of the original choice. And again, they would say we're not talking about justice here. We're not talking about, even the universe judging you for your actions. It is simply cause and effect. They couch it in very scientific terms. I drop a ball, it falls. I punch you, I get bad karma, because that's how the universe works. Did I answer your question, William, or? Okay. Yes. Good question. That is another of those metaphysical speculations that are unhelpful. So, in fact, there was a Buddhist, one of the people who considered following Buddha, who came to Buddha and asked. He said, if I can find the quote, because I thought it was striking, he asked, when did the universe begin? Is it infinite? Is it eternal? Help me out. Help me understand things. And Buddha responds, I have not told you these things, quote, because it is not useful. It is not fundamentally connected with the spiritual holy life. Is not conducive to aversion, detachment, cessation, tranquility, deep penetration, full realization, nirvana. So basically, we can't know. We're not made to know. There's no need to. Well, we're not made at all. But there's no need to know. So they just would put that off in. Who knows? We are here now. So we have this karmic sense, this right and wrong, or good and bad that follow from our actions. And we are caught into it because of the self. So again, we imagine that we are a self, and therefore the karmic debt falls on us. But if we could become enlightened, if we could realize that there is no self that is doing the deeds, and there is no self that would have the moral consequence, or the amoral consequences fall upon us, therefore we would then be enlightened, and we'd reach that state of nirvana, escaping this karmic cycle. Now again, I'm sure all of you are going, but wait, how does reincarnation work when there is no self? Well, actually, reincarnation works as well as the first incarnation. If you've solved the problem of the first incarnation, where you've got a theory of, again, humans being almost an illusion of self, well, it's not that much of a stretch then to say that illusion of self just gets reincarnated back into another illusion of self later on. So essentially, that's the Buddhist picture of reincarnation. So we want to then lose that self. We want to lose that idea of our own existence that creates dukkha. By then following the fourth truth, oh, by the way, getting rid of dukkha by realizing that there's no self, that's the third noble truth. So then how we do that is the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path, not numbers again. So the Eightfold Path is basically the way in which you're saved insofar as salvation would happen. In the Buddhist picture, you're at least saved from dukkha, and you are able to enter this state of nirvana. But yes, question.
Yeah. If you're not actually real, then when you get enlightened, you're supposed to go to nirvana. Is that also an illusion?
That is another metaphysical speculation we shouldn't bother with. So basically, that's, again, people ask Buddha, so what's going to happen to you when you get to nirvana? And again, that's, well, I can't say. It's not existence. Again, these are categories. There's no categories. It's not existence. It's not non-existence. But it's really good, apparently. But again, you can't actually say if it's anything. It's just that. Yes.
If there's not a self, how does the non-self get enlightened or do anything? I mean,
right. That's. I think I would have to be, well, a Buddhist monk spends decades learning. And I think a lot of it is trying to reshape your brain to think in these almost lack of categories. So I can't grasp this, except I can hear them say it, I can repeat it, but I can't really get it. And I think it's partially because that's just not a natural way for humans to think. So basically, whatever it is, think of however you want to, imagine, say, a computer. Where, the computer, there's these, the memory and the CPU and all, and somehow it starts to have this faint sense of selfish selfness. But it's not really there, it's just an illusion. So essentially, again, it's an illusion of self, but it's a sufficiently real illusion of self that, again, it's suffering, it's having this unpleasantness. So if we can just lose that again, then whatever nirvana is, we can get that. And that's about, and I'm sure, again, if I was actually a Buddhist who'd been through this for decades, I could give you a slightly better picture. But I've read a good deal of Buddhists who have been Buddhists for a long time, and it's not really clearer, at least to me, than just that sense of, again, whatever that self is. And actually, if I could back up a little bit, remember, also, we're thinking of it from that Western standpoint that wants clear categories. We want to understand. And the whole sense of Buddhism is I can't give you that propositional philosophy. I'm not giving you the truth. I'm giving you something you can experience and see that it's true. So, the Buddhist would say he has experienced it. Now, again, it takes a lot of effort, hence the Eightfold Path that we'll probably talk about next week. But, meditation, long years of effort, and then you can start to feel your own non-existence, and perhaps that would help to cast light on some of these other questions. But again, it's more of an experiential over a long period of time rather than a propositional idea, if that helps somewhat. Did I see a hand? Yeah.
Basically, they would just be saying, there's no room for your logic in our religion.
Yes, but no. Because, again, people are logical. We're made in the image of God. We can't just say, this totally doesn't make sense, so we're going to throw it away. So there's basically, what they do is they carve out a spot where they say, logically, logic would not work. Again, we can see, it does, actually. It's not true, but it does make sense. That we can say, it's almost like we say of God, in a sense, not that he's irrational, but that there are things we would not expect to understand about him. And again, we do expect him to be at least logical, rational, because that is in his nature to be. Again, he is God, he is the Logos. But there's still that sense of there's something that I can understand why I can't understand it. And that's essentially where Buddhism draws just a much larger category of things that you would expect not to understand. This is actually a pretty decent place to stop, so I can give a quick summary of a couple more points just to set us up for next week. But does anybody have any other questions at this point first? Yes. Yeah. Right. And that's essentially, this is, there are questions we do not know how to answer, so that gets built into the religion, which I think is a fairly practical way to go, honestly, if you don't have the answer. Yeah. Right. So what you can anticipate, sort of the foretaste of next week as we look at the Eightfold Path, I will not take you through in great detail all eight steps. They are for your, if you're interested, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Basically, it boils down to seeing things correctly and doing the right thing, which, again, creates some cognitive dissonance for us as we hear that an essential element, the core element of Buddhist practice, is doing the right thing, even though, again, there's no objective right or wrong. And that's an intriguing thing that we'll talk about more next week. But in fact, Buddhism has a tremendous list of rules, of ways that people ought to live, ought to act. And I think there's something striking to be found just in that simple fact that we'll talk about more next week. But for now, just sort of the picture that I want to leave you with is, again, of suffering being real, of it's created by the illusion of self. We have to get rid of it. And then what we'll talk about next week, the way that we get rid of it is through basically being a good person and through understanding things properly, through wisdom and knowledge. Because I do always like to give you at least something fruitful to think about at the end here, instead of just finishing on what to me is a somewhat depressing note, I do think, again, just as we talked about before, that as I have really dug into trying to understand Buddhist thought, what has been pressed upon me is God through his absence. Again, in looking at Buddhism, the absence of God does just make me appreciate that there is a God, that there is a God who tells us truth, who is with us in the boat, who, when we say, "Do you care if I am perishing?" that his answer is yes. That is really the fundamental difference between Christianity and Buddhism. So next week we'll look at basically how you get to nirvana and then hopefully draw a few just interesting contrasts, and then also give some suggestions for, if you encounter the Buddhist, whether the more traditional Buddhist from, again, an East Asia kind of traditional cultural Buddhist, or more of the Steve Jobs Buddhist, some ways that we can hopefully share the gospel with either of those. Last call for questions. Okay, go have some lunch. Oh, actually, I'm sorry, we'll pray, and then we'll go have some lunch. Our Father in heaven, we are so glad that you are, that we are not left to our own devices. Not only that you exist, but that you even came. You made yourself one of us, flesh and blood like us. And so you suffered for us, that our weight of suffering would not be borne by ourselves, but that we might have salvation, taken to be with you in glory forever. Thank you for that. And Lord, may we see more and more the beauty of what we have in you, what you have given to us, and be motivated by that to share these things with those in need. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.